So I think sometimes these this pair of what's called bodhisattva practices or perfections, that one is framed as either meditation, true meditation, or concentration. And here the person has written higher consciousness. Because I don't think the meaning in this context, although the word is the same, it's samadhi, means just concentration in terms of focus. It really addresses the issue of refined and then expanded consciousness. Because if we have refined and integrated our consciousness, allowed it to expand and become full strength, allow all the dross to fall off, like, well, we have quite a lot of that, don't we? And it dilutes the clarity and power of our minds. So that is one of the most important practices for a bodhisattva. In this tradition here, we practice within the Mahayana tradition, which, we use the full breadth of Buddhist practices, but we like to emphasize meditation in the context and with particular emphasis on metta as well as mindfulness. Lots of Buddhist practice focuses on all the wonderful applications of mindfulness and penetrating the nature of reality through mindfulness. Mindfulness at all the different levels of our bodies, our feeling, the nature of the mind, and then the nature of reality. So as we refine our mindfulness, we are able to calm and make spacious each of those domains, and then see into the underlying characteristic of each of them, which characterizes wisdom, because all things have the same nature. And that is traditionally framed as no nature. And sometimes this is expressed in the word shunyata or emptiness. So all things have the same nature, which is no nature. Sounds a bit of a big ask, but it's, you know, it's hard. And when I've been listening to the talks over these weeks, and people say, you know, you develop a way of being in the world that is selfless, there's part of me that goes, oh no, I have to have a self to look after myself. So I think a lot of the framings of Buddhist, the ideal really, can seem really quite scary from a mundane or an everyday point of view. You think, how can we possibly manage? What happens if we don't have a self? Who will get us dressed in the morning? and will I become, a doormat? And I think, I'm pretty convinced by now, actually, it's when we're at this level and we contemplate this level of spiritual practice, it's beyond our capacity to even intuit. It's like an 8-year-old wondering why on earth somebody might want to go to a pub and sit down on a bar stool all evening. It's not something that is attractive to them. So at different stages of our development, different range of things become comprehensible. And I think I've learned not to contemplate, whereas I can have trust in and develop faith in the teachings and the the, what do you call it, the word of or the commentary of people who are further along the path, because they've said, what they've said about things at sort of the level I'm practicing at is true, and I think, yeah, that's all true, it rings true to me. I can see my friends who are along the path a little bit, and yes, that seems true. But I know that to try and contemplate things that are too much beyond me, my mind sort of crumples and makes literalistic, hard and fast judgments about whether it's a good idea or not. So the whole idea of being without a self can seem scary from some points of view. Other times it seems a beautiful idea and very doable and delightful. And I can dwell in those ways of being for periods. But then there's other periods where, and I think this is again quite characteristic of spiritual life, we have periods where we have integrated that mental and emotional content that we have become aware of and our understanding of the nature of things. And so we're going along quite nicely, everything's working quite nicely, but it's sort of like putting a strong light on an area of being, it throws a shadow. And so very often after we've had a period of ease and clarity, a period of sort of bumpiness and confusion and not workingness seems to emerge. And so there's often another level of material to come into awareness of, come to be spacious around, to allow to take its natural place in the mandala of our being, rather than trying to reject it or grab it towards us or make judgments about it. So I think what I'm trying to say is that in terms of wisdom, whereas we can learn the formulas, it is helpful to get what we call right view. So we learn various intellectual formulas as to how to conceptualize the nature of things. It can be pretty tricky trying to understand more deeply those things that are well beyond us. Because as I read the other day, it said, when we ask questions about the nature of reality, and we're at a less mature level, we can't understand the answers. Yeah? And then when we get to that level, we don't need to ask the question. It's true, isn't it? I know that to be true. So you're burning up with a question about how come they do this, how come they do this, and then when they tell you the answer, you damn well don't understand it. And you think, why can't you speak plain English, or, you know, if, what, but, you know, that sort of thing. And then when you've been around for a bit longer, it's completely obvious, the answer, and there's no question there. So I guess over the years, that's what I've found to be true. So in terms of the Bodhisattva path, these last weeks, we had the introduction from Ratnavura, and then we had a lovely talk from Natalie, and she introduced the importance of ethics and generosity as foundation practices. Because when we practice ethics, we learn to be trustworthy to ourselves, yeah, and trustworthy to other people. And particularly if we're taking quite an individual path in life, because the spiritual path is not a conventional path in our society. We have to be very clear and very confident and relaxed about what we do, so that we don't find ourselves in sticky places where we feel compromised or pressured. We have to be really clear and confident about what we're doing, and by practicing ethics thoroughly and in a more and more refined way, we develop that confidence in ourselves and the path we're taking and our relationships with others. And then, of course, generosity is the natural response to the world that we, as we develop more and more understanding of the conditioned nature of our own being, and how everybody, all beings, are conditioned by their circumstances and their upbringing and the environment and other people, and how we all suffer, not because we actually set about to be bad, but just because we're conditioned to do these silly things that we do habitually. Yeah? And so as we start getting a little bit of insight through meditation, the practice of the precepts of our own silliness, really, we develop very often a more kindly and helpful attitude to other people. And so it becomes sort of an easier thing to do, to be supportive of them and their journey. It's also a practice that's advised for people who want to develop spiritually, because in whether or not you feel like being generous, it's a jolly good thing to practice being generous, because just in the thinking, what would this person like? What could I do to help this situation? It helps soften, dissolve the hard crust of our individual self that is, we believe in it so thoroughly, don't we? That, you know, you think when you're in a miserable place and you think, you know, you're just, here's me, miserable, I'm always miserable, it's always like this, and what's more, I'm the most miserable person in the world. Yeah, and it feels so true, doesn't it? And then, you know, 5 minutes, 2 hours, 3 days, 6 months later, you can hardly remember feeling like that. But that tight, miserable, self-absorbed feeling is the subjective experience we have when we're very attached to the idea of a separate self. And so as we practice our metta practice, our mindfulness practice, we start to feel, to get to know that perhaps we're not this fixed separate self that we feel so strongly we can be sometimes. And so this is a beginning of wisdom, beginning of insight. And so naturally, as a fruit of this, we feel gratitude to situations that support us, we feel sympathy and empathy for people who are suffering and want to help them a little bit. We feel kindness and generosity towards ourselves if we're practicing the precepts, and we practice kindness towards ourselves. So it's a practice, but it's also a fruit of wisdom. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the threefold path that the Buddhist teachings often formulated in, the practice of wisdom, ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Sometimes the eightfold path is formulated like that. So the Buddhist eightfold path is all those things that pertain to your ethical life, like being, having skillful and kindly speech, honest speech, earning your living in a skillful way, practicing the precepts in it. Yeah, so this is your life. You've got a good, trustworthy foundation of the precepts. This makes it easier to meditate. So ethics forms a foundation for meditation. Meditation, when we refine and integrate our mind, allow our mental states to expand, wisdom, because our mind is finer, it's more like an elegant sword blade than a steamroller. We see the nature of things. We just do. Is this true for you in your life? Yeah, when your meditation practice is active, you see what's cooking quicker and you don't walk right into the hole. You sort of walk around it more often. Yeah? And if you do get into the hole, you get out of it without blaming other people. Yeah? Who pushed me in here? So keeping up your meditation practice, it's just self-evident, isn't it? We are wiser. And what's more, we're kinder. And so kindness is wisdom. It's the compassion element of wisdom. Because if you think of, you have this ethical base, foundation, trustworthy, you have the meditation practice, metta, bhavana, and all the Brahma viharas, as well as mindfulness, all the applications of mindfulness. And out of that, and through particular practices that we can do, reflective practices and different meditation practices, but even if we don't do them, wisdom still comes, doesn't it? You're in the middle of a situation with somebody and you think, nope, I will keep my mouth shut here. Yeah, and that's wise quite often, isn't it? So that is just everyday wisdom that rises as a fruit of a good meditation practice. However, wisdom goes well beyond that. Our whole psychophysical being, the whole essence of who we are as a being that's a product of the whole of evolution has ended in you. Everything that's happened in the whole universe has its fruit in this being that's sitting here, that's self-conscious. Reflector. Both, you know, it has got a biological basis, but also has an element of to be able to contemplate and imagine. It's extraordinary if you think of how extraordinary you are. Yeah, so you've got this incredible potential. And we can, or beings who take their spiritual potential seriously and seek to develop it deeply can release volume, I don't know if it would, in any case, this capacity that is so unknown or even unimagined by most of us most of the time. I think it's only when we take on spiritual life seriously and spend serious time contemplating the lives of people who have pursued the spiritual ideal, the Buddha, other spiritual teachers, that we begin to develop our imagination about human capacity, our own capacity. Because mainly we don't go there, do we? It's like somebody who you know, can play chopsticks on the piano, that's sort of our level of sort of awareness of human potential. But then you hear a great musician playing and you think, wow, this potential for beauty and communication well beyond what I ever imagined. And spiritual life's a bit like that. We might be a bit beyond chopsticks, some of you probably are. But you know, the capacity to imagine what human beings are possible, that is possible for human beings, is enormous, and it does have to, we do have to apply ourselves to imagining what we could become. Some of us who take on visualization practices do that imagining through those visualization practices, but there are other ways too. So I think where I was going was that with meditation, if you think of a being as a field of us as being fields of energy, and mainly our consciousness is dominated by our senses. The pain in our body, comfort. We spend a lot of time seeking to fill our tummies and keep warm and comfortable. So our physical body and our senses, in the Buddhist tradition, the mind is seen to be a sense, because it takes in stimulation and we respond to that. So most of us are pretty dominated most of the time by our physical senses and the mind sense. And that space that is not taken up by direct physical, you know, sensation is we fill in all the gaps with feelings and emotions and opinions, and we sort of do a good job, don't we, of sort of filling up our lives pretty chock full. Huh? And if we reflect on the nature of this consciousness, we sometimes become very aware, or often when we start to meditate, how coarse and disintegrated and all over the place it is. Sort of. Sometimes I think it feels a bit like that. You see those photographs of all that junk floating on the top of the ocean, all that plastic and stuff. Those great rafts of plastic. Probably your minds are not like that, but sometimes my mind can be. So, you know, not much clear water or bright sunlight penetrating through. Just pretty solid space junk. So, when we take up a serious spiritual practice, a bodhisattva, because, you know, I think most of us here to some degree are called novice bodhisattvas, when you just think it's a good idea but you haven't. Yes, it is. There's different levels of bodhisattva. One of the speakers early on talked about Sangharakshita, our teacher, saying that Dado Rinpoche, one of his teachers, he felt was a real bodhisattva. Now, actually, when I read through preparing for this talk, I thought that's like saying someone's fully enlightened, basically, to be a real bodhisattva. It's sort of the end of the bodhisattva career. So to begin with, most of us, well, everybody starts off as a novice bodhisattva. You think the ideal of enlightenment sounds pretty okay-ish, sort of probably, and you like the idea of being nice to people, and so you sort of buy into it, you know, at that level. But it hasn't gone very deeply. It's sort of like a spray painting job, really. But once we've gone a little bit deeper and we've become more integrated and it's penetrated a bit deeper, then people start to become what's called bodhisattvas of the path. And that's where hard work happens. You really take on this path as a way of refining and developing your consciousness. Independent of where we might be, most people here, I imagine, are meditating. And meditating is a method of integrating our consciousness. and purifying the consciousness and creating a more positive habits in our minds. And in doing this, sometimes we might experience, particularly if we go on meditation retreats, because many of us need these very supportive conditions to experience these more expanded mental states. But what happens when we bring our consciousness together in an integrated, refined, relaxed manner that we do when we get our meditation established? The consciousness starts to expand, yeah, and it becomes increasingly easy to meditate. So at this level, we're having to make quite a lot of effort, noticing the wandering, bringing it back, saying, you know, am I putting too much effort, too little effort, am I bringing enough heart to this? So we're sort of working at what I think of as the karma level, you know, of conscious will, effort. Once we get integrated, it's as if something else, well, it's higher consciousness, I suppose, so it is something else, but it's not something different. It's a different nature, I suppose. But it's as if something joins in, so it becomes easier to meditate, it becomes easier to stay focused on what we're attending to, and yeah, it's just, and becomes very pleasurable quite here. Yeah, that's the nature of concentrated meditation. It's pleasurable, so it draws us along. And some of the battles that we've had to have just to get us onto the seat earlier on become less pressing. One of the things that happens as our consciousness starts to expand is that we become less attached to bodily sensations and less, yeah, so we, sometimes people have the experience that they may have had like painful knee and they think, oh, I have to stop meditating now. And of course you have to make sure your posture's good and you're not hurting yourself. But often what happens is people's consciousness starts to expand. They no longer feel driven to attend to physical sensations. So the amount of our consciousness that attends to or identifies with physical sensation reduces. And that energy that was bound up in our physical body goes into a refined expression of mind, intellect, emotion, refined positive emotion, often joy or bliss or deep calm, yeah, and the intuitive faculty, where we directly see with a completely clear eye, starts to expand. Because usually we're not very aware of or in touch with that direct intuitive seeing, are we? Yeah, sort of not even, you don't even hear it half the time. This last weekend we were on a little retreat that had the title Entering the Mandala of Aesthetic Appreciation, and through meditation and other aspects of the program, we sought to develop an appreciative, open-hearted, connected way to be. And of course that's part of the nature of an enlightening mind, to be appreciative and see things aesthetically rather than see things pragmatically, seeing people and objects in terms of beauty as well as truth and goodness. So as we go along the path, we feel drawn by and supported by, because we are more open to them. We see and we're open to beauty, and it nourishes and supports us. goodness or skillful way of behaving is more natural, and it supports and nourishes. And truth becomes easier to see, and so it's easier to travel the path, because instead of having to fight with our unconscious conditioning and opinions that sort of says, nah, this is not worth the effort, you'd be better applied, better doing a master's degree and getting a better job, and you know, all those sort of arguments that we have that pull us away from doing our spiritual practice. So as we as our meditation practice deepens and our mind expands, more of our psychophysical energy withdraws from our awareness of the physical body, then it starts to withdraw from even sort of more intellectual cognitions. You don't think so much, you just see more directly. And certainly emotions, emotional turmoil and worries absolutely fall away. So you can still have the same issues in your life, and when you contemplate them from a refined, integrated, expanded mind, you just say, that's happening. And you don't feel tossed around by it. It's as if, taking the metaphor of the ocean we had before with all the space junk, we drop deeper down into our being, we still see things clearly. We see things, but we're not tossed around as you might if you're on the more superficial levels of your mind. So what happens is, as our meditation practice gets established and our mind becomes finer and we move into higher states of consciousness, a mind can become like a very clear seeing laser beam, completely undistracted by the details of our lives and all the conflicts and you know, either or's ways of thinking that we're usually trapped in. And it's much, much easier. And so I guess what I'm saying is that higher states of consciousness, more refined meditative consciousness, leads naturally to a wiser way of seeing. With greater perspective, you can see the nature of things. And that flows down into our practice of ethics. So it becomes natural to behave. I said before, you're in the middle of an issue with somebody and you think, I'll keep my mouth shut. Because you think that you've got gap written right across your chest. That's a sort of that's one of the strategies that we use when we become aware of sort of like aggressive energy arising or craving energy, and we just think, no, hang in the gap. Just sit there, feel your feet, breathe, become mindful. Yeah. And make good choices rather than being driven to do, you know, I have to get that person or I have to run away. Okay, so we have more, it's more creative. Yeah? Which is wise, of course, because our nature is to be creative. Our capacity is to be creative. Yeah, but we're not. Often we're just like trapped in a very tight little mechanical way of being, penny in the slot way of being. Yeah, so ethics, meditation, wisdom, flowering of wisdom, informing ethics, behaving in those ways that initially we have to take on as training precepts. You know, I will keep my mouth shut rather than gossiping. I will make an effort to tell the truth. I will make an effort to be kind. To begin with, we have to make an effort. As wisdom flowers, it starts growing up in us And we naturally become like that. Yeah? So what was effortful becomes a natural flowering. And the process keeps on going. We become more and more drawn to the good, the true, the beautiful, to spiritual life. It becomes less of an effort and more of a pleasure. And so eventually we'll become full, perfect Buddhas. It's just a matter of time. And of course, I think one missed. I think I know what I was going to say. I was going to say that wisdom, insight, is completely natural. We just have to follow the path. Follow the path more and more fully, and wisdom naturally arises. In the spiritual traditions of the world, people often have experiences that are interpreted as God speaking to them, you know, being visited by angels or whatever. Yeah, and the way that we frame such experiences in the Buddhist tradition is that it is just like higher consciousness. It's a natural expression of a more refined, illuminated human consciousness. There's a lovely book here, Life of Full Attention. The fellow who wrote it talks about awareness as being like a guardian angel, which I like the idea of, because I quite like the idea of angels. And he says, well, you know, if you've got awareness, as you grow your awareness, as it becomes brighter and you get more and more of it, it's like you've got more and more angels looking after you. So it's a nice thing to look at things. But we do understand that it's a conceptualization. There's not, you know, people flapping around up there with wings and feathers and stuff. So wisdom is completely natural, and what we understand is that it's dependent on conditions. It arises like everything in the universe, dependent on conditions. So all we have to do is set up the conditions. Now that's not all that easy actually, but we have, it's sort of like being adventurous, yeah? It's about the path has been found. The Buddha did find the path. We just have to rediscover it and help. And by working with our friends and helping others, because very often we teach best what we most need to know, don't we? Teach with great passion those things that we sort of... And of course, when you think of the three levels of wisdom, you will all have had experience in many areas of your life where you understand something intellectually, or you think, yeah, yeah, that's a really good idea. You'll sort of agree with it, it rings true. So that's, in the Buddhist understanding, the first level of wisdom. It's called listening wisdom. Okay, Sudhamaya Pranya. And then, the next level that's talked about is reflecting wisdom, where you take the teaching and you put it against your own direct experience. And you practice it a bit, and you reflect on it, and you think about it. And you get, you know, hard-won personal faith and understanding. Often what happens, like when we're in situations like this, and we're giving talks, or in study groups, we talk to each other, and I'm talking to you, and I'm sort of telling you what I think I understand about things, and other people do the same process, and that's sort of working at that level between listening wisdom and reflecting wisdom, because it's sort of a bit of both, isn't it? We we can often, after a while, we learn to speak and talk about things that we sort of know to be true, and we sort of partly can do it. Yeah, but if the situation gets really complex and we get really tired, we can't behave like that anymore, and we go back into our automatic way of behaving, our familiar level of behaving. So there's a whole lot of behaviours that we can only do if we have got good conditions and we're quite conscious. Yeah? But with time and meditation, that's why meditation is such a useful tool, because our mind becomes really, really refined, and we're contemplating not at the level of intellect. It's more like it's intuitive, really. We're holding these teachings, these intuitions, these knowings, these questions in an enormous sphere of intuitive knowing. And what happens sometimes is, I mean, that doesn't happen lots of times, but the phrase that I really love is a turning around in the deepest seat of consciousness. So the way we see the world changes radically. We develop like completely different eyes. We see things from a different point of view. Yeah, and that everything becomes easier and easier after we've done that. We've had lots of small easiernesses, yeah, and sense that we're being supported by another force that makes it all less effortful. But once we've reached that stage, and because Buddhism's been going on for so many years, 2,500 years, in different contexts, people have developed different frameworks to view spiritual path within. And so this idea of turning around the deeper seats of consciousness has got a lot in common with what's sometimes called the rising of the bodhicitta, or the point of no return, or knowledge and vision of things as they really are. So all those sorts of terms that you may hear have got similarities in that they're around having a very refined, elevated consciousness that contemplates the nature of reality, and things change quite radically. And things, spiritual life generally, becomes significantly easier. And that's not to say that it becomes without any difficulties, because difficulties still happen, because of course we're a great mass of conditioning. And our conditioning will still be rolling on. But what happens is we see things more clearly. Yeah? We think, whoops, this is not a good idea. Right as we're sort of in an old established pattern. Sometimes we'll have been able to pull ourselves out of a pattern back here, but as we were talking before, but we've got so many patterns. We're just a great pile of patterns. And what we have to do is bring awareness and kindness to these patterns and allow them to release, and the habitual nature of them to be freed. So we can use the energy for pursuit of the good, as Erica was talking about the other night. She was saying, talked about patience and energy in pursuit of the good. Patience I often think of as, or kashanti, as love. So it's having a warm-hearted attitude to what's happening, even if it's something annoying. So that's why you've been patient. Hard, big ask, eh? And energy in pursuit of the good is, again, it's in pursuit of the good. It's not in pursuit of worldly accomplishments. Yeah, it's what's truly beneficial to us, what really nourishes us, frees us. So that's about all I think we need to say, because there's such a lot, there's just an enormous amount of interlocking frameworks. And today when I was here, I wrote all up on here and I wrote there, I sort of thought, oh, there's all these different ways of framing wisdom. there's all these different models, there's all these different images and symbols, and it just, you know, keeps you off the streets for many years. So I think we'll do.